About a month ago, the Pew Center for Research released a survey about the changing religious landscape in the United States. It was a follow-up to a survey that was first conducted in 2007. Simply put, the study suggests that we live in a society that is becoming increasingly secularized. Christians, as a percentage of the population, Christians by sheer number, are decreasing. In 2007, when this survey was first conducted, 78.4% of American adults identified themselves as Christians. That number has dropped 8 percentage points in 8 years. There has been a corresponding increase in the number of people who self-identify as atheists or agnostics, or who say they just don't have a religion. They don't care enough about God to say, I don't believe God exists, or I'm still searching for God. They just say, I don't have a religion. God may or may not exist, but I don't want any part of what those people are doing. 22.8% of Americans fall into that category. This relatively new group of people called the religious nuns, the people who mark none of the above in their response. And that is up 6 percentage points since 2007. Younger adults are more likely than older adults to identify themselves as not having a religion. 35% of millennials, a millennial person who is a person who was born between 1981 and 1996, 35% of people born between those years say they have no religious affiliation. Only 9% of Americans say they were raised without any religious affiliation. 9% of Americans say they had no faith in their household growing up. So what that means is that people are raised in a religious home, they get to a certain age, and they reject the religion they were raised with. Doesn't mean that they've never been exposed to God. It means that they have rejected a religion. And there are all kinds of different ways to interpret that data, to respond to that data. Some people think it's the end of the world. Either figuratively, because the world they have known, the world of the church, is changing. And the church that they have known is no more. And some people think it's the literal end of the world. God will not just stand idly by while the church is on the decline and do nothing. He will bring the world to an end. Others say that historically, Christianity has experienced a decline just before it experiences growth. The church, when faced with a crisis of declining numbers, finds itself, rediscovers its spirit and its passion, and starts focusing outwardly instead of inwardly. Still, others say we are living in a culture where it is no longer fashionable to say you're religious, no longer fashionable to say you're Christian. And so that some of the decline that we're seeing in organized religion in general and Christianity specifically is because people who were only Christians in name only are no longer involved in the church. People who were never really invested in the Christian life to begin with are leaving. I don't know what the right answer is. I just know a lot of my colleagues in ministry are wringing their hands over this because their churches have taught them and they have started to believe it that they are responsible for the growth of the church, that it is the minister's responsibility to grow the church. And they feel this pressure because we are living in a culture in which the growth of the church is very hard to come by. It's in the context of this culture where God's name is mentioned less and less that we read this morning in the book of Esther, a book known largely for the fact that it contains no miracles, has only the implication of prayer, and does not mention the name of God. A book in the Bible that does not mention God. If you're ever on Jeopardy, and the answer is this Bible book does not mention the name of God, I want you to buzz in and I will accept some of your winnings if you're that gracious. What is Esther? That's the piece of trivia that differentiates this book from all the others. The only book that does not mention God. And that fact has led many students of the Bible to ask over the centuries, why is this book in the Bible? Some church leaders throughout history have been fairly vocal in their opposition to this book, their disdain for this book. John Calvin did not include Esther when he wrote his commentaries on the books of the Bible. Martin Luther said, I am so great an enemy to Esther that I wish it had not come to us at all. Man wrote, a mighty fortress is our God, and I give him props for that. But I disagree with him on his analysis of Esther. For all of us living in a culture known for the rise of the religious nuns, N-O-N-E-S. For all of us living in a culture known for the rise of the religious nuns, there is a lesson for us in the mere inclusion of the book of Esther in our Bibles. And the lesson is this. The absence of God's name does not mean the absence of God. The absence of God's name does not mean the absence of God. The absence of prayer does not mean the absence of God. Difficulty in understanding God's will does not mean the absence of God. Declining church attendance does not mean the absence of God. Declining affiliation with the Christian religion does not mean the absence of God. God's work persists. God's will persists. God's love persists. Oh, love. Josh, our culture is going to hell in a handbasket. And you're talking about loving them. All you want to do is love them. They're leaving the church. They're leaving God. And all you can talk about is loving them. Well, in the absence of better ideas, in the absence of more effective ideas, in the absence of more Christ-like ideas, yes, I want to love them. And yes, I think you should want to love them too. To all of us who feel that the wall between us and them is thickening, to all of us who are tempted to wring our hands about the changes that we are witnessing in our culture, to all of us who are tempted to reject them because they reject God, I say that evangelism has always required us to have the ability to see God's work where God's name is not mentioned. To share God's love where God's love is not recognized. To see God at work in the story of others and in the story of ourselves. We read Esther for the same reason we engage our culture. Though God's name isn't mentioned, God is certainly present and God is certainly at work. When you shake your head over the trends you read about and the trends you see, remember, God remains at work. Some historical context to the book of Esther. The year 586 remains one of the low points of Jewish history, for that is the year that the Babylonian king Nebuchadnezzar rode into Jerusalem with his army and captured that city and overcame it. God's judgment had finally come to God's people. It had been long prophesied. There were plenty of opportunities to turn around, and this was the judgment coming to fruition. In the presence of an enemy king and an invading army. And so began the 48-year Babylonian exile of God's people. They were taken from their own country. They were uprooted to modern-day Iraq in the hopes that their culture would be utterly decimated. If we take the best and the brightest from Israel, Nebuchadnezzar surmised, if we gut this culture and try to absorb it into our own, this culture will no longer exist. Psalm 137, a psalm of lament, was written about this time in Israel's history. Also a song sung by Bob Marley, "By the Rivers of Babylon, we wept when we remembered Zion." How can we sing the songs of Zion in a foreign land? And yet, even in this period in its history, God was at work taking care of people, strengthening people. Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego, all of them were faithful to God in the midst of this Babylonian captivity. The exile ended in 539 when the king of Persia came to power. Persia became the superpower, knocked off Babylon. The king had no issue with the Jews and said, "You all are free to go home." And many of them did. Thousands of them returned back to what was left of Israel, but some did not. Either they were afraid of the trip, or they had become enmeshed in Babylonian society. Of course, many Jews were born in Babylon during the captivity, and that was the only home they had ever known. Of the many Jews who didn't go back home after the exile was over, I must make mention of two especially. Mordecai, who held a government office, and Hadassah, Esther, Mordecai's cousin, an orphan girl who Mordecai raised practically as his own daughter. King Xerxes is the ruler, and it's apparent to us as we read Esther that this man loves the trappings of royalty. He loves being king, loves the perks, the special privileges. And when we encounter him in the book of Esther, he's finishing a 180-day celebration with a 7-day banquet. A 7-day banquet. Not eating meals every day for 7 days, but a 7-day banquet, like a cruise ship. 7 days of eating. The Bible tells us that at this banquet there is drinking without restraint. We have details of lavish surroundings, marble pillars, fine linens, golden goblets. While the king is off partying with the men, Queen Vashti is partying with the women in another part of the palace. On the seventh and final day of the banquet, the king, drunk both on wine and power, sends word to his wife, the queen, that he would like for her to put on her crown and come into the room where he and the other men were partying. And the Bible's implication here is that this is not the request for the queen to make a royal appearance. He's requesting that she come and be eye candy for his guests. The queen senses that the king is trying to objectify her, trying to treat her like a piece of meat. And to her credit, she has the self-confidence to say no. Yes, he's the king. Yes, he's her husband, but he does not own her. What an important story for our daughters and sons to hear. Love does not make someone use someone else. You cannot use someone and honestly call it love. Neither should you prove your love to someone else through your willingness to be used or objectified by them. Love has no place in objectification. Love has no place in using someone else. The queen refuses. The king, of course, says, oh, well, no, he's furious. She's embarrassed him in front of his friends. She's offended him as a husband. She's disobeyed him as king. This is now a matter of honor. This kind of behavior cannot stand. If the women of Persia heard that their queen stood up to her husband and thought for herself and made a decision for herself, they might be tempted, heaven forbid, to do the same thing. And so an order is issued that the queen cannot be around the king. There's a restraining order. And Xerxes suddenly becomes the kingdom's most eligible bachelor. And in true bachelor fashion, Anne, I'm sorry. In true bachelor fashion, there's a 12-month beauty contest where all the eligible women are brought into the king and they are given makeovers. It's in the Bible. All the women of the kingdom are given makeovers. They're all dolled up and they're paraded in front of the king. And the king gets to choose who the queen will be. And at the rose ceremony, he chooses Esther. Glad somebody gets it. Enter Vice President Haman, the king's second in charge. The rule is that when Haman comes into the room, everyone else bows down in reverence before him. And everyone did, except Mordecai. Mordecai decides that this rule is fine for the pagan Persians, but he's too Jewish, too principled to bow down just because the rest of them do. So he stands up, makes a point of not bowing down to Haman. And of course, that offended Haman's fragile ego. So he hatched a plan not only to destroy Mordecai, but to destroy all of Mordecai's people, all of the Jews. He gets the king's ear and he tells him what he needs to say in order to get the king to agree to this plan. Your Highness, there are people in the kingdom who refuse to follow the rules. Their disobedience represents a threat to our national security. We must do away with them. If you will just sign here, I'll take care of all the details. And the king, okay, he signs it away, not realizing, of course, that his queen is Jewish. And he has just unwittingly signed orders to have her killed. Esther 4, beginning with verse 1. When Mordecai learned of all that had been done, he tore his clothes, put on sackcloth and ashes, and went out into the city, wailing loudly and bitterly. But he went only as far as the king's gate, because no one clothed in sackcloth was allowed to enter it. In every province to which the edict and order of the king came, there was great mourning among the Jews, with fasting, weeping, and wailing. Many lay in sackcloth and ashes. When Esther's eunuchs and female attendants came and told her about Mordecai, she was in great distress. She sent clothes for him to put on instead of his sackcloth, but he would not accept them. Then Esther summoned Hathach, one of the king's eunuchs assigned to attend her, and ordered him to find out what was troubling Mordecai and why. So Hathach went out to Mordecai in the open square of the city in front of the king's gate. Mordecai told him everything that had happened to him, including the exact amount of money Haman had promised to pay into the royal treasury for the destruction of the Jews. He also gave him a copy of the text of the edict for their annihilation, which had been published in Susa, to show Esther and explain it to her. And he told him to instruct her to go into the king's presence, to beg for mercy, and plead with him for her people. Hathach went back and reported to Esther what Mordecai had said. Then she instructed him to say to Mordecai, "All the king's officials and the people of the royal provinces know that for any man or woman who approaches the king in the inner court without being summoned, the king has but one law, that they be put to death, unless the king extends the golden scepter to them and spares their lives. But 30 days have passed since I was called to go to the king." Esther's words were reported to Mordecai. He sent back this answer: "Do not think that because you are in the king's house, you alone of all the Jews will escape. For if you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance for the Jews will arise from another place, but you and your father's family will perish. And who knows but that you have come to your royal position for such a time as this." Esther fasts for 3 days. She approaches the king just outside of the innermost room, and he summons her to him. "Esther, whatever you want, name it. It's yours." Her response was, "Spare my life and that of my people, for we have been sold to be killed." The king is mortified. Who has done this? It was Haman. The king exacts revenge on Haman. He is hanged on the same gallows he constructed for Mordecai. Esther saved her people. On the day that the Jews were to be killed, Haman cast lots to determine which day. It was the day of Purim. And to this day, Purim is a feast day in Jewish religion. It was to be a day of destruction, and it became a day of salvation. What do we learn from this beautiful story in which the name of God is not mentioned? Let's return to our context. John Calvin and Martin Luther saw this book without the name of God, and they wanted to ignore it, as is in the case of John Calvin, and they openly detested it, as is the case with Martin Luther. What about us? Living as we do in a culture where God's name is not mentioned very often, do we ignore it? Do we openly detest it? Or do we see, as Mordecai saw, as Esther eventually saw, that there was opportunity even in the midst of hardship? Maybe we can make the best of our situation the way that they did. The Jews were a minority people practicing a minority religion in a strange land. That's not quite what we're experiencing as Christians in America. We still are the majority of the religious people in this country, even though our majority is slipping. That, it seems, is largely beyond our control. What can we do to make the most of the opportunity? Sometimes making the best of something is all we can manage. Sometimes we find ourselves in situations over which we have no control. Maybe we were born at the wrong time. Maybe we should have been born into a more religious culture. Maybe we should have lived in a time where it was more fashionable to be Christian. Maybe we should have lived in a time where church membership equated with social standing. Or maybe we were born for such a time as this.